Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report here under lockdown in California, the new hot zone for coronavirus. It's exciting times that we live in. Exciting because of the pandemic, but also exciting because joining us today on the program, Jason Carter, journalist, hey. Producer, television personality, host of Jason Unleashed and RuPaul's Drag Race, pit crew member. Whew, that's a lot of Thank titles you got.
Hey man, they have me working day and night, excited to be here with you, John. So much is happening in the world, and just a lot of craziness is taking place in our country. So let's talk about it.
Let's do that. Well, before we jump into the news, I want to give people just a minute to get situated, maybe hit the like button, maybe share the stream really fast. We haven't really talked about the experience of these past 3 months or so. How has the pandemic affected you?
Do you see my face?
What am I supposed to be seeing on your face? Because you look like a model of health.
Well, you know what?
Do you see my face? Do you see this?
Yes. It's very well lit, John.
It is.
John, you're one of the sexiest men on the net, by the way. yeah, your wife would agree. But, you're welcome. COVID has, you know, like everyone, John, it's been hard to deal with. We've had to really reimagine our lives because we want to stay safe. We want to keep people safe. We've got to find ways to be productive in a time that has really lent itself for us to have, I would say, barriers of us being productive. But with that said, I've been healthy. I've been sheltering in place with my husband and my new dog. I love my new dog.
What? And a new dog?
Yeah, I have a dog. I have an American Staffordshire Terrier named Valentina, who I did not know that breed was banned in like all of humanity. It's such a cute puppy. Yeah, it's banned in like 9 states. It's terrible. Wow. But I've been busy with my own show, Jason Unleashed Daily on Instagram, and just, you know, making sure that I keep my mental health in check and I stay healthy.
That's awesome. And, you know, by the way, if the dog happens to wander in frame or near you and you want to lift it up on camera, that's allowed on this program.
Actually, she's not allowed on this floor in the house, though, because we have to. It's a territorial thing, and she craps and poos in places she shouldn't. We don't want her crapping and pooing down here yet.
Okay. So everyone, manage your expectations. Probably not going to see the dog, but people are very happy to see you. I see people shouting, "Pit crew, OMFG, yes, I knew I recognized you, heart pit crew." Let's see, got a whole bunch of hearts here. I love Jason. Aww. Hearts for Jason. And you forgot Pop Trigger. I should have mentioned that.
Well, yeah, hey, John, how could you forget Pop Trigger? It's iconic. It is legendary.
It is. I miss that period in TYT. I miss Pop Trigger. I miss What the Flick. I miss a lot, unfortunately. I miss leaving my house. I miss so much.
Same.
But anyway, thank you to everybody who's already joining us. A couple thousand people watching right now. Please hit the like button. That would be really cool. And we will be reading your super chats and comments and tweets at hashtag TDR Live and all of that as we go on. But there's so much news, including breaking news, that we should probably jump right into it. How about it, Jason?
Let's do it.
Ghislaine Maxwell's breaking news of the morning has been arrested. The former girlfriend and longtime associate of the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein was arrested earlier today on criminal charges linked to his alleged sex trafficking operation. She was accused in an indictment of helping Mr. Epstein recruit, groom, and ultimately abuse multiple girls, including one as young as 14. She also faces perjury charges. And this arrest came nearly a year after Mr. Epstein was charged in a federal indictment with sexually exploiting and abusing dozens of underage girls at his mansion in Manhattan, his estate in Palm Beach, Florida, and other locations. So this was pretty shocking breaking news, huh?
Shocking breaking news in the sense that people have been waiting for Ghislaine to be brought to justice, right? Because in the whole Jeffrey Epstein saga, she has been the most, according to reports and the alleged claims made by the victims, and also in Netflix's documentary of Filthy Rich Jeffrey Epstein, she was complicit and also the woman who masterminded and filtered these women to Jeffrey, right? She's a very, from what reports have said, she's a very, very smart, very educated, very well-connected, privileged woman that had a lot of access to a lot of wonderful things to entice these people to buy into what Jeffrey was selling. And then once they were roped in, that's where the egregious acts took place. So I'm glad that this has happened. And also, speaking of perjury, she lied on stand and said she had no idea of that any of this was happening. But yet all accounts made by people involved, people that were directly involved and adjacent to the activity of Jeffrey Epstein, had corroborated the story and corroborated the claims that, yes, Ghislaine was public enemy number two next to Jeffrey. So not shocked that this has happened, just a little surprised that it didn't happen sooner.
Yeah, great point. And one thing I want to clarify, just because I've followed this case, but I don't necessarily know all the ins and outs. Is she alleged to have participated in the actual sexual abuse in the, mm-hmm. the instance of rape? She is, directly.
Yeah, she, I mean, according to claims and reports, that she was also naked, if you will, unclothed, and was in the room. And the reason why she was there was because it was an attempt to make the younger victims feel more comfortable that a woman's presence yeah. was in the room. Which, again, you have to be a pretty sick individual to even go in those lanes and think of those roundabout reasonings to victimize someone. Mm-hmm. So all we revealed is what's going to happen. But, I mean, it's an interesting thing that in this conversation about Jeffrey Epstein, she was always on the periphery. No one ever said, well, whoa, wait a minute. This woman really was the mastermind behind Jeffrey. Jeffrey provided did the acts, but Jeffrey provided the infrastructure, if you will, for this to take place. But she was the one who orchestrated the activity to enact the actual egregious acts.
Exactly.
So here we go, Ghislaine.
Yeah, and you know, I forget exactly who was involved, but you remember that sort of like the Hollywood sex cult ring where they were recruiting mm-hmm. people not long ago that had the same sort of case where they have the women to sort of provide social proof that they're the ones going out and bringing people in to make them a little bit more comfortable. But I mean, Epstein really ranks up there amongst the most despicable people of our lives, and she has to be on basically the same tier that she participated in it. She, like, could it have happened to the extent it did without her? I'm sure he could have found someone else. Would they have been as skilled in manipulation as she was? That I don't know.
I know we have to wrap, but you make a great point, because if we go back to Roger Ailes, you know, it was alleged that he also had an assistant who was a woman that filtered facilitated that behavior. So it's these types of things we have been seeing, and I'm glad that we're now been able to unearth and unsheath and really get into what this is. But this has been going on for forever. This type of two-party system of victimizing and sexually assaulting people has been happening a lot more than we think.
Yeah, 100%. So Jason, we're responding to this breaking news. She's been brought in. She's going to face charges, but we also have to understand the context was that, you know, Epstein hung himself. That's the mm-hmm. story. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into it, but we're getting multiple super chats right now. One from Christopher says, "How long till Epstein's girls suicides?" Evelyn says, "Keep Maxwell alive long enough to talk." So look, I don't know exactly where you come out on this, but I do know that almost all of the social media traffic I've seen about this story coming in is, can we just watch her, maybe? Like, not like last time where everybody mysteriously goes to sleep at the same exact time. Considering that, hypothetically, if there were people that have not come out as being a part of this story, Jeffrey Epstein could have identified those people. As intricately involved as she was, she hypothetically mm-hmm. could as well. Do you share any of those concerns about her safety, or do you think, no, she's brought in, now we'll actually get some justice here?
I mean, look, she is a human being. We don't know her personally. We don't know what the last, I would say, 3 years has been, because this has been ongoing for a couple years now in regards to the investigation with Jeffrey Epstein, of course. I do think that she, from what's been reported and what we've seen and what I've read, I do think that other names are going to come out that have also been complicit and have aided these two in their crimes. We should definitely watch her, but Ghislaine does not strike me. And again, I don't know this woman, but from what's been reported about how smart she is, and even though Jeffrey was brutally smart as well, I don't see her as a type of woman that's going to be committing suicide or hanging herself or anything in the near future. But who knows? No one thought Jeffrey Epstein would have done that, allegedly, and that's what's allegedly happened. So the time will tell. Time will tell. But I think she did. I think Jeffrey Epstein's death is just, of course, it's just as dire as the crimes he committed, because These people need justice.
Yes.
Their lives are forever, I don't want to say ruined, but have been changed forever because of what they have claimed he has done. And so for her to take the easy way out by committing suicide is disgusting. You did the crime, do the time, be truthful, be honest, and let these people heal. Let these victims have their day in court or have some closure for whatever that is and have justice brought for the way their lives have been ruined.
I 100% agree. And if she reveals more people, good. I'm glad. And I know that some Republicans are like, well, you know, maybe a Dem will come out. Okay, good. Good. If any Democrats were involved in this, release their names. I don't care how big or how powerful they are. I want to know who is involved in this. And I'm sure the victims would love it. The victims that have come forward, but even the ones who haven't are still, I'm sure, watching to see if there will be justice. And they know some of the other people that are still out there, identified in the documentaries and everything like that. And so that would be great. And for all that she did, she deserves to spend a lot of time in prison.
And real quick, John, why does this have to be a bipartisan conversation? Why does it have to be a political engagement? I understand that Jeffrey Epstein had ties to Republicans and also Bill Clinton, who was a Democrat. But let's strip that away and get to the human aspect of this. And also how triggering this is, not only for people who were involved, but also for survivors of sexual assault to watch this.
Yeah.
To have to relive their own traumas adjacently by seeing this in the news, by seeing this documentary that was splashed everywhere by Netflix. Let's talk about that. I think that's more important than, oh my gosh, maybe a Democrat was involved or maybe a conservative Republican from Maine was involved. No one cares about that. What we care about is justice and making sure these people heal from their trauma.
Good point. Good point.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump faced with the second part of the first wave of coronavirus. Will his messaging change? Will he take it more seriously? Well, as this montage of recent comments of his, including up to just yesterday, will show, don't set your expectations too high.
So at some point, this stuff goes away, and it's going away.
If you look, the numbers are very minuscule compared to what it was. It's dying out.
It's fading away. It's going to fade away.
And it is dying out. The numbers are starting to get very good. I think that at some point, that's going to sort of just disappear, I hope.
You still believe so? Disappear?
Well, I do. Yeah, sure.
And I want to be very clear. So that's how he spent the latter half of June. The entirety of it, you know, as the cases have been exploding. That last quote, though, I think we're going to be very good with the coronavirus. I think that at some point that's going to sort of just disappear, I hope, was yesterday.
Mm.
Following 2 weeks of rising cases.
There, and that's where the rubber meets the road, especially in a place like Florida, which I was in Florida last week, and the conversation with people about corona was, you know what? All these states have been reopened. They were closed. They have all these cases. Florida's been open for weeks now. We have zero cases. And now Florida has become a hotspot. With that said, Donald Trump, operative word, I hope so, kind of. Those are all things that elicit a lack of confidence in what you're saying. And if you want to get really crunk with it, the concrete news and numbers and studies coming from reputable places that are showing that cases are spiking exponentially day over day, any smart person, my nephew who is 9, could tell you that no, this is not going away, bro. The second wave is rising and upon us. Corona winter is coming, you guys.
Oh, God.
Corona winter is coming. Donald Trump, John, I do not understand how. I get it. This is an election year. He wants to get elected. He's a politician. That's what they do. We are in a time of civil unrest, racial injustice, and he is, instead of talking about what the zeitgeist and what the American people are talking about, and that is those things, he wants to talk about preserving historically racist statues and Confederate flags and things that are just super, that knowing that we know do not need to be visible in anywhere in the country. That's more important. Yeah. That's more important. So, I mean, what else can you say about this? Really, yeah. Donald Trump pulled. There is no prayer. There is no manifestation. There is no, I don't know, dream of a dream I could have that would give me confidence in our president. And I know I'm probably going to get flamed by really conservative people for saying that, but the proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the tweets. The proof is in those statements that he makes. Mm-hmm. An idiot. Point blank, period. Come for me, please. I wish you would.
Well, yeah. Come for Jason. He says, I don't have confidence in the leadership. Well, let's run a few experiments. In other areas, would you have confidence in a leadership figure if their response to the crisis was what he's saying now? If you were riddled with cancer and your doctor said, just don't worry, at some point it's just going to just disappear, I hope. Or if I was leading you through the woods and we came across a black bear and I said, don't worry, it's just going to disappear someday, I hope. Would you have faith in me in any of those cases? What if it was the bear, and the bear had killed 130,000 Americans over the past few months, and I told you, don't worry about that bear, it's just going to go away at some point. Would you have faith in me? No, you would not. This is madness.
No, you wouldn't.
Madness.
It's, John, madness, insanity. There's just a myriad of different words we could use to describe this. But at the running core of all this is also disappointment, fear, and frustration, because the American people, we want to get back to business as usual. And we know that business as usual will never be the same again. We will never emerge from this, the country, the society, the people we were prior to March 17th, or even March, when we were forced to go into hibernation, if you will. So, and I
to continue the bear metaphor,
right? You know, it's but it becomes a point of, like, you get tired of hearing the same thing over and over again. You get tired of being forced to listen to someone who just doesn't care, and you stop and you ask yourself, well, am I interpreting this right? Am I the crazy one? Mm-hmm. Am I seeing this differently, or am I not present? Am I projecting something within myself that can't reconcile the stupidity that's coming out of the White House?
Yeah.
But that's just it, John. It's stupidity. And people are dying. We're losing lives. Corona is a thing still. Corona's not, it's not this imaginary thing it has gotten better. We have been able to get some kind of control. And that control is education, us being taking autonomy over our health, making sure we're wearing the mask, making sure we're sanitizing, things of that nature. We've been able to take control that way. But it needs to be beyond that. Mm-hmm. And the White House has the resources to make sure that we are going beyond that. And that's just not what we're seeing. It's just not happening. It's not happening.
Yeah. And so, you know, Trump's strategy is to just continue to deny it. But we're looking out there every day at the records being made, and it's scary. And so I just want to give a quick update on where we're at nationally. More than 48,000 coronavirus cases were announced across the country on Tuesday, the highest daily number since the outbreak began, with 8 states reporting single-day highs: Alaska, Arizona, California, Georgia, Idaho, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas. And if that's scary, I said Tuesday, what about Wednesday? The record was beat once again with more than 50,000 cases in just a single day. And as you point out, things are getting better in terms of, you know, the death numbers. I mean, they've sort of stabilized now, but they're lower than they were a month or 2 months ago. But the cases continue to go up. We just passed 50,000. Dr. Fauci in the last 24 hours said he wouldn't be surprised for us to hit 100,000. And that's verified, tested infections each day. We know that the actual numbers are far higher because while we're now testing about 500,000 people each day, that still is a very small percentage of all of the people that are likely to be infected with this. And so, yeah, the only hope at this point is that the death numbers do not rise the way that they almost certainly are going to now that we're seeing increasing cases again.
I agree. And again, to just drive home the fact that we are now armed with the knowledge to protect ourselves, because if you look back to March and April, when this was like, what is happening? It was beyond dire. Every press conference was New York City, 8,000 dead, 36,000 dead overseas. Luckily, we now know how to protect ourselves. But in that list of states, John, what is interesting is that some of those states have gone on record before saying, we're good. I'm not going to say which ones, but one of them is a major state in the union. And they were being very vocal about, well, you know, we have it under control. We have minimal infections. And now they're on the list of having the most. So this virus doesn't know race, doesn't know sexual orientation, doesn't know creed. It doesn't care. It does not care. And us being naive and ignorant and becoming lax is only going to be to our detriment. So we have to continue wearing the mask. We have to continue the social distancing. And we have to take ownership of COVID-19 in the sense and in the frame of our health.
Yeah. I think I know what state you're talking about there. And by the way, I want to say, and I will say this on literally every show, every time we talk about case numbers, it is not just because we're testing more people. You can see here, the positivity rate is rising even as we test more. If there's not an explosion cases as you test more, the positivity rate should be going down, or at the very least keeping steady. It should not be rising. And it's rising far more in some regions, implying that this is an increase in numbers of infections, not just those being diagnosed.
People die every year from like pollution, like respiratory illness caused by, like, it's millions of people.
Right.
So let's just put it in perspective.
Right.
You're most likely to be killed by someone who's texting and driving, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Perspective, fine. I don't know. I think those are all great points.
It is scary.
Because when you knowledge, right? The flu, all these people die of the flu, but there's also ways to combat and cure the flu and take care of the flu, especially in the United States alone. So I just feel, and I don't want to get all conspiracy theorists with it, but I feel like we're on the precipice of something bad with this coronavirus. For TYT members, but it just seems like every single day there's 400, 200 more new people that are now infected with this. And it's like this onslaught of where did this come from?
So from when coronavirus was first in Wuhan, we started covering it originally on the Darren Report on our Meanwhile in International News segment. And then as it began to spread around the region, we covered it. We're scared about it. Cases started to come into the US. It was scary. And so I like to think that I was taking it seriously. However, in the middle of February, I believe on February 17th and 23rd, you appeared on The Young Turks. And we sat on a panel together. And you were very worried about what was about to happen. And I, both on the panel and internally, was thinking, okay, look, I'm scared too, but come on, it's the US government. They're not going to just throw us to the wolves. And you were 100% right. And I was 100% wrong.
And it's okay, John, first of all, thank you for that admission. As your brother and friend, I forgive you for your being wrong. But I mean, I've read enough Stephen King books to know what an epidemiological nightmare looks like. And this had all the makings of that. And I mean, and John, how quickly things escalated, in a matter of days, it was the life as we knew it was over. You know, and so, I'll take that pat on the back,
Don't sell yourself short, because you called that more than 1 month before TYT went into lockdown and home shooting. Like, things did rapidly progress, but lockdowns weren't even a conversation for about 3 weeks after you were expressing your fears. So I want to give you even more credit. You were way ahead of the vast, vast majority of people appearing on news shows at that time.
Well, thank you. But I mean, here's the wonderful thing about what we do here at TYT. We have these conversations that go deeper beyond just what's being reported. We really flush things out and have nuanced conversations. So luckily we had a platform to talk about it, and our viewers you know, they're also ahead of the curve. That conversation could have possibly sparked maybe ideas of how these people could have protected, how our viewers could protect themselves going forward. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah. Donald Trump has not appeared to change in his strategy of trying to pretend that coronavirus isn't here, that we're not still in a pandemic and all of that. But apparently, his team is starting to fracture on whether this is a good strategy going forward, with CNN reporting that a divide has emerged inside his inner circle over whether he should turn his attention back to the pandemic or continue to focus on reopening the economy. I believe that is how his inner circle pitched it to CNN. I would say that that is an insane, ridiculous, false dichotomy, that it's either acknowledge the pandemic or be concerned about the economy. How has their strategy of rushing to reopen doing, you know, how's that doing in Texas and Florida as they begin to close down back again? But anyway, apparently, Jason, they are starting to wonder whether Trump's just, you know, pretending it's not here is actually working.
It's not working. Well, look, like again, an election year for Trump. Of course, he wants to get reelected. Okay, so the inner circle also consists of Mike Pence, who, according to reports from CNN and other outlets, are saying that no, he's concerned that Trump is ignoring the pandemic because he wants to focus on things like I said earlier, preserving statues of Christopher Columbus, right? Yeah. He's a human being. He has a very complex and intense job being the president of the United States. So I understand you have to pick and choose your battles. Maybe, I mean, I'm not a politician. I never had a job, but I do think if he does not address coronavirus, because that it's in the zeitgeist, John, much like I said, civil unrest and racial injustice. These are things that the American people are talking about, point blank period. You cannot turn a blind eye. So you just can't.
Yeah.
So his people need to find a way for him to have a balanced enactment and a balanced plan of attack when it comes to those two things. By him ignoring COVID, that could ultimately hurt him more than him trying to take on, I don't know, what else could he be focusing on? Tweeting, I don't know. Him ignoring COVID is not going to fare well for him, because that is affecting people beyond the economy. That people, like as you said earlier, people are dying. That's a health scare.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally think by him not talking about it, it's only putting the nail in the coffin.
Yeah,
really, because also COVID has had the effect on us financially, with our livelihoods, families being torn apart by COVID, immigration, so many things have been affected by this pandemic that reach farther than some of the things that Trump wants to focus on. So I think it would be in his best interest to turn it back around, walk it back to talking about this pandemic.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And as you point out, it's affected so many other areas of policy that to ignore the pandemic is to ignore a lot of the crises that are on people's minds as we get towards this election, let alone the actual substance of, you know, the damage it's doing right now. Yeah. I for a long time have been saying I don't understand. And morally and in terms of public health, this strategy is abhorrent. It's evil. Mm-hmm. It's killing people literally every day. So many thousands of people have died that didn't need to. But also pragmatically, even if you didn't give a damn about those people's lives, this country is in the grip of the worst domestic crisis we've had in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And you're going to try to get reelected in a few months. Pretend to give a damn for your own interest. He could have all the Republican politicians, all the right-wing media presenting themselves as the wall between the American people and this pandemic. But they're not. Mm-hmm. That's not the strategy, and I just don't understand it.
I think you make a good point about, like, at least because politicians, it's an optics thing, right? They want to appear. I mean, much like Trump standing in front of that Herald Church in New York with the Bible, that was an opportunity for him to appear to be something. So you make a good point about Trump appearing to at least care. But you mentioned abhorrent. You mentioned unthinkable, unconscionable. It's also irresponsible for the leader of our country to not talk about this. And for someone who has gone on many a platform and says, I'm for the people, I care about the people, I'm a man of the people, allegedly, for you not to address this is simply irresponsible.
Yeah.
And think about your own family. What happens if Barron comes down with COVID? What happens if Melania, Ivanka, Tiffany, remember Tiffany, the other daughter? Eric, Donald, whoever.
That's not gonna sway him.
You don't think? Oh, he's like, Tiffany, who's that? Yeah. But you know, really put yourself, if you care about the people, put yourself in the shoes of the people.
Yeah, 100%. Because he's not doing that, several of his top aides, including Mark Meadows and Jared Kushner, have begun to worry about his chances of re-election. You have some people like Meadows and Kushner and Hope Hicks. They don't want him to talk about the pandemic. Just stay away from it. Don't talk about drinking bleach or anything like that. But Pence and Navarro apparently do want him to take a more active role in doing something about this. And then you get mixed things like this, which sort of undercuts it, with Secretary Mnuchin apparently saying, asked if he has any regrets about the White House pressuring states to reopen, saying, no, absolutely not. I think we've had a very careful plan, again, working with the states. It's primarily the state's responsibility. So similar to what Trump said, you know, a couple months back, they're not taking any responsibility, even though many of these states that opened earliest, shockingly, have seen a massive rise in coronavirus case numbers.
Well, look, I'm glad Mike Pence is trying to knock some sense into the president. And the reason why they probably don't want him talking about it, because every time he says something, it's the dumbest, most asinine, unthought out response ever. They're probably like, let's just do damage control on that sense. But guarantee behind closed doors, there has been probably heightened and very heated conversations with the president about how to address this publicly. And people are probably frustrated that he just can't seem to do that right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he gets that he's not capable of messaging in an empathetic way about this. I think that's why once they backed off of those press conferences, you know, those ridiculous shows, he backed off. He doesn't seem to think about it much, doesn't talk about it much. He wants to talk about other things. And by the way, there was a perfect example of that this morning when he wanted to talk about the jobs numbers. And obviously there are other major crises like the pandemic. Take a look at his retreat as soon as he was done speaking.
Be your president. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So you hear cases rising across the country, mm-hmm. and he's out of there. And remember, this is a press conference. It's not just a speech. It's supposed to be a conversation with the press. Before he gave it, you had reporters saying, I forget exactly which one, it's the one that he keeps bickering with, saying, you know, they keep saying these are going to be press conferences, but then they don't answer questions. And indeed, he ran out of there as fast as he could as soon as that thing was over. Didn't take any questions whatsoever.
Well, in those instances, John, this is why the administration is an abject failure, because you hire people, you have a team of people of Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Ivy League graduates that get their rocks off by addressing these issues, crafting these amazing statements that are factual, that dive into the actual facts and numbers and a plan of what to do, and then let them find. If the president doesn't want to talk, okay, whatever. We don't want to hear him anyways, but let his team of masterful people do the talking and give us answers. Because at the end of the day, what do we want? We want answers. We want to be assured and reassured that the road ahead is gleaming and looks a little bit more sunshiny than the bleakness we have been experiencing for the last, what? Well, how many days have we been in quarantine now? 106 days or over that? Maybe I stopped counting.
Yeah,
that's what needs to happen if the president doesn't want to take accountability and be who he needs to be for the American people and our country.
Let's talk now about the disappearance and apparent murder of soldier Vanessa Guillen. It's been more than 2 months since she disappeared from the Fort Hood military base in Texas, and it has been a very long wait for her family and those who love her to find out more information. But all the information that has come since then has unfortunately just added layer of tragedy upon tragedy. In the months since the disappearance, the investigation that was conducted turned up little. So her family actually had to get involved, saying she'd been sexually harassed in the months before on the base. Obviously, that's something that seems important when a woman has disappeared. So they retained a lawyer trying to keep her story in the national spotlight. We have on Tuesday of this week, the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command said in a statement that agents who had returned to an area of interest found what had been described as partial human remains after analysis from a forensic anthropologist. Investigators have yet to determine the identity of the body and said that due to the ongoing criminal investigation, no further information will be released at this time. Although from a statement from the family and their attorney, they believe that this was Vanessa that was found. I want to read just a section of that statement from the family attorney saying, "Our hearts are broken. We feel pain, frustration, and devastation. This shouldn't have happened. If this could happen to Vanessa, this can happen to any one of our sisters, daughters, and mothers." And so that was tragic. Then we have another development with a soldier who'd been suspected potentially in the disappearance, killing himself after police confronted him. This is just yesterday we found out about it. And Texas Rangers have arrested another civilian suspect in connection with Guillen's disappearance. You have one killing himself and then one being taken into custody. We have a bit more of the historical context of this, but this is sort of how the big parts of the case have developed, Jason.
Devastation and frustration and sadness. I echo those sentiments of the family because this is the horrible thing to have to go through. Like they're trying to identify a body. They don't know if it's her. And it's just like, again, the word I've been using the word trauma a lot, but all those things are very traumatizing. And I think this speaks to a conversation and things that have been reported throughout the years in regards to the environment in the armed forces when it comes to women. This isn't the first time people have been speaking out about mistreatment, sexual harassment, rape, a myriad of different not unfavorable acts within the armed forces when it comes to women. And they are right. This could, if the family doesn't keep this in the public conversation, much like justice for Breonna Taylor, we move on so quickly in a news cycle. We move on so quickly via social media. We move on so quickly via the news that justice sometimes is elusive because we aren't giving enough energy to keeping the conversation going. So I'm glad that they retained an attorney. I'm glad that the family's taking it into their own hands to get justice for their family member. They have to. Now in 2020, that's the only way you can get anything done, unfortunately, because our justice system just isn't as effective as it needs to be.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like imagine going months and not knowing for sure. I mean, finally getting what is likely, you know, this terrible news that they found the body, because you were probably still holding out at least some hope that hypothetically she could still be alive, a small hope, but still a hope. And then to have this soldier kill himself, potentially having had information about it, you know, that's going to be devastating too. Now, they did arrest someone. We have no idea if they will have been involved, have any information. But I want to give the audience just a little bit more of the background of what some of the family thinks might have played into this. In mid-June, their lawyer said she had turned up two alleged instances of sexual harassment towards Guillen at the base. In one case, a superior allegedly walked in on Guillen while she was showering. In the other, a colleague made vulgar remarks during Spanish. According to the lawyer, Guillen had told several people that she was afraid to report the alleged incidents. And the family is saying that, you know, I guess no one is shocked that the military isn't taking seriously sexual harassment and sexual assault against female soldiers. That has been the story of the military for decades.
Right.
But they want something done about it. They want legislation. They'd like it to be named after her for the military to finally take this seriously. And maybe, like to your point about the trauma, maybe that, if it happens, could be a part of the healing that justice has been evaded for literally months at this point, but if they can help to stop other incidents like this happening, that might give them a little bit of closure.
I think, I mean, I would hope and I would pray that it would. Much like what we're seeing with Black Lives Matter, and I'm not trying to equate the two as far as the importance, because they're equally important in their own entities, but just the way the reckoning that it's happening within society when it comes to things of this nature, I absolutely think that the family needs to do whatever they can, and I know they are, to, yes, have a bill passed named after her, have a library named after her, have a whole policy in the armed forces training handbook or manual or anything of that nature named after her, because things, until you take those types of steps, and even those steps, John, are not enough.
Yeah,
nothing will ever be enough. Nothing can ever replace a human life. Nothing can ever replace the death of a loved one. Nothing will ever make that okay. But the silver lining is, if you can stop this from happening going forward, if you can draw awareness and enact change mm-hmm. in an institution that has been very, very staunch and ironclad of not changing, then for all it's worth, that is a minor win that could have, that could yield so many valuable dividends down the line.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. And, you know, thank you to the comments pointing out, I'd actually forgotten the second person that was arrested is a woman. Some people are saying it's potentially the girlfriend or the wife of the person who would kill themselves, or at least another soldier. The information that I found in my research was very mixed. So we'll see. I know that, by the way, I believe right now, the family and their lawyer are having a press conference about some of the recent developments. So, you know, we'll be checking on that for future broadcasts. And, you know, I just want to add this on both as part of the conversation about the way that the military has treated its female soldiers. And also, potentially, there have been allegations that this could have played into the story. All of this, as far as I know, is speculation. But, you know, back a number of years ago, TYT reported on this story. Female Fort Hood soldiers were recruited for a prostitution ring. You know, and eventually there were multiple charges filed about this. This is the same base, and it was just a few years ago. They need to take the safety of their soldiers far more seriously, and unfortunately just it does not seem like a massive priority.
It's not. I mean, and again, of course, the reporting, everything's always, you know, allegedly there's claims that, I mean, until someone is guilty, that's all it'll ever be. It's just claims, right? But there's movies, there's articles. Where there's smoke, there is fire. And for years, when the same conversation keeps happening in different instances, but the elements and the things that make them all common are just that, the same in common, there has to be beyond a smidgen of truth to what's happening. There has to be. How else can you chalk it up? What else can you chalk it up to? Yeah. Really?
During the pandemic, we've done multiple stories on the state of American meatpacking plants and the intersection of meatpacking with super spreader sites for coronavirus. And ever since these meatpacking plants were forced to stay open, apparently mostly so that we can ship meat to China, and we're going to give you numbers on that, I have been dreading hearing the news that cases are starting to explode in these plants once again. But I just saw some news that actually makes me a lot less worried about finding out about that, because apparently, although the cases will begin to spread again, we won't know about it. So that's reassuring. On June 8th, the health department for Burke County, where the Case Farms facility, this meatpacking plant, is located, they had 136 new COVID cases, a 25% increase in a very limited period of time. Yet neither the company, county officials, nor the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services would confirm whether those cases were connected to Case Farms. So let's be clear. The meatpacking plants are just not going to report that their employees got sick anymore. So hey, problem solved. We don't have to worry about it. I mean, the workers do. They're screwed because apparently these meatpacking plants haven't done much at all to improve worker safety over the past few months. They're still packed in shoulder to shoulder. PPE is still far too rare, but they're just going to stonewall investigations into how many of their employees have gotten sick. So, Jason, are you reassured?
Not reassured at all. And look, the meatpacking industry, they've shipped over $1 billion in meat across to China. I mean, it's big business. Some of these companies are historically very American companies, and in their communities employ the majority of the people that work in these communities. They work in those plants. So at the end of the day, what they're worried about is their bottom line. And that's what a lot of any company is worried about, is their bottom line. And them not reporting the numbers, but kind of pivoting and saying, we're not gonna report the numbers in our facilities, but we'll report the numbers in our community, is just them, their way of passing the buck and not being held accountable, which is disgusting. Be open about it. There are some companies that are, but majority of these companies are taking that route, and it's criminal. You're doing. Not only are you doing a disservice to your employees, you're kind of killing your employees, really.
Yeah. And we're gonna get to some of those numbers in just a second, but I want to be very clear. Like, you know, sometimes we exaggerate for effect. The idea that they're just stonewalling, this is explicit. The mm-hmm. Burke County Health Department, where Case Farms is located, does have data about where people with positive cases work, but they're choosing not to release it. So, like, they could tell us if the cases mm-hmm. are at the plant or not. They don't want to. Why? Because it's in the best interest of the people in the area? No, but it's certainly in the best interest of Case Farms. So it's a pretty sweet deal that they've got set up there. I wonder if other places would have that same sort of deal. So let's talk about some of the numbers, because we alluded to how bad this has been for the workers. Let's see. As of Thursday, there were nearly 3,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in 28 meat processing plant clusters around the state, the department said, but would not specify further. And maybe they just happen to be in that region. It doesn't have anything to do with the plants. We'll never know, apparently.
Right, apparently.
Ridiculous. But anyway, as of right now, more than 36,000 meat processing and farm workers have tested positive for COVID-19, and at least 116 have died. Although, again, when these companies are stonewalling you, who really knows? It could be far worse than that. But tens of thousands of employees in one industry have gotten this virus. It's just devastating.
And it's devastating. And the numbers, John, don't lie. The numbers don't lie. When you have these, independent people that come in to try to extract the real numbers and get to the bottom of it, that's when you have companies that send out a Rhonda or a Margaret or a Debbie to speak on behalf of the company and not really be transparent. All we want is transparency, and transparency is what we need that to save the lives of these people who are afraid to even speak out. I mean, some of these articles, these people are going on background and being unnamed because they're afraid of the repercussions naturally and, of course, of them telling the truth about these working conditions. And as I said earlier, in a lot of these towns, this is the bread and butter of those towns for the community. Mm-hmm. So they have no choice but to return to these working conditions. And beyond, there needs to be an FBI investigation, I think.
Yeah,
it needs to go beyond just FDA and these small. I mean, the FDA is not a small entity by no means, but beyond these small independent investigator outlets and investigation outlets to get to the bottom of this. This needs to be on a higher level of sleuthing by the government, because if 36,000 people in this industry have tested positive, and that's just what's been reported by these people, and we don't know the real numbers, imagine how many more are actually there. And in the long run, months or maybe a year from now, how many people are going to be positive or even dead?
Yeah.
Yeah. Packing chicken fingers, you know?
Well, so essential, obviously. Again, everyone, check out Beyond and Impossible Meat. Very good. Had a burger recently.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't meat. Still very tasty. And I want to tie this back to two other stories that we covered recently. One, just so that I don't forget, I saw someone in the chat mention the new pig H1N1. Yeah, we have a video up about that on the channel from just the past couple of days. But also, we were talking maybe about 2 months ago, and we were talking about the meatpacking plants, about how they'd had all these massive spreads of infection. The workers were talking about how the fact that they're shoulder to shoulder, there's no way that you can avoid contact with other people. And then stories came out in some of these states that if you had the opportunity to go back to work when, for instance, plants are reopened, and you decide not to because you're scared of getting coronavirus, you will be ineligible for unemployment at that point. Mm-hmm. So you either potentially lose everything and are penniless, or you're forced to go back to work at a place that is not going to prioritize your safety. And we talked about that, and I guess to some extent it predicted at that point. It was fairly clear, and now we're seeing that. And what they have done is, federally, the Republicans are saying, we're going to protect companies from lawsuits over people that get infected while at work. And now they've got this cushy situation set up with the boards of health where they don't have to report if the infections are happening. So they're not actually prioritizing stopping infections. They're just prioritizing their public image and making sure that it doesn't look as bad as it clearly is. But when you listen to the workers, you get the true story. So that is what's going on. We don't know exactly how it's going to go, but considering the pattern so far in terms of cases and deaths, we have a pretty good idea.
And John, with that said, the workers have no reason to lie. Really, they don't, because livelihoods are at stake. People want to be able to provide for their families. They want to get a check every other Friday or Thursday of the month. They want to make sure that their livelihood isn't upended because COVID-19 has put millions of people on unemployment, has put millions of people in situations that they never would have imagined in this day and age of our economy. Mm-hmm. So I don't think these people are lying, but it goes back to no one cares about the people. No one cares. You're just a number. You are replaceable. You are dispensable. You are not a human being. You're just a line item on a sheet that if they could, would erase you, because what does that do? It puts more coins, more dollars back into their bottom line.
Yeah. It's the end of the week, and so it's time to take out the trash. Okay, this has been a particularly trashy week, Jason. Who would you like to throw in the can?
So we're going to take this to the good old Midwest, Michigan, Auburn Hills, Michigan, where a woman pulls and cocks a gun on a black lady and her daughter. Now, this happened at a Chipotle. The woman with the gun bumps into the mother of the child. They get into an altercation, and it escalates outside of the Chipotle with epithets being thrown back and forth. Also, a man enters and defends the woman who pulls the gun. But essentially, it's the woman refused to apologize for bumping into the lady. She was very rude, and the woman just wanted an apology, rightfully so. And also, she probably didn't get her guacamole at Chipotle, so she's a little pissed about that. But it escalates because after the first interaction in regards to the physical contact, the woman with the gun hops into her minivan and begins to pull out, and from the video looks like she's going to run over the woman who's questioning her. Things escalate even higher, and the woman jumps out of the van, releases a gun which looks like a Glock, cocks it points it at the woman and her daughter in broad daylight in a parking lot in Auburn Hills, Michigan at a Chipotle. The Carries are even more vicious, violent, and unhinged now more than ever, John. And this could have ended up with a murder. This could have ended up very bad. This could have gone so bad very quickly, because this woman had no problems pointing this gun, pretty much cocking this gun and saying, hey, listen, if you don't step back, I'm going to shoot you. And the woman who accused the woman of bumping into her wasn't being violent in any way, shape, or form. It's you have to watch the video. It's graphic in the sense of you see someone who has zero regard for human life. I understand protecting yourself, but in an instance where there is no need for violence and there hasn't been any violence that's been enacted on anyone, this is outrageous. 100%. So yes, the woman with the gun is a garbage person.
Throw her in the trash.
In the trash.
So, and you, look, you're a very reasonable person. So you say, I understand, you know, the need to protect yourself and all that. But like, I never understand. Did the woman with the gun think that the woman with the daughter was going to kill the woman with the gun with her bare hands? Like, who thinks?
Well, okay, so
who thinks?
Right,
that?
Great question. But that also goes back and leans on the notion that black people, and this has been said time and time again, and in studies, that black people are seen as violent. Hyper aware, and we're predatory. That is the idea that some people that are not of color think that black people are, that we're just these violent individuals that at any chance we are looking to get into a scuffle, we're looking to hit someone, mm-hmm. to accost someone. And that is not the case at all. That is not the case, especially a woman with her daughter. A woman with her daughter wants to protect her child. Why would she engage in something that could possibly potentially put her and her daughter in harm's way? I mean, look at this. This woman has a gun. Like, this is a stance that you would take in a heightened situation, in an armed robbery, and it's something that's beyond bumping into someone at a Chipotle.
It's insane. And yeah, like you point out, it could have so easily, we could have been doing this story that a woman died because this woman, like, mm-hmm. it was that close. There was a story I saw today of a park ranger shot this guy, a black guy, through the heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The guy hadn't done anything. He wasn't armed. He had no drugs, no alcohol in his system. Not that that would make it okay. And the guy shocked him and said, yeah, I tried to stun him and he hit me. And so I shot him through the heart and killed him. Absolutely insane. And the thing about this case that you're pointing out, and we've had a lot of Karens on Garbage People recently, it's that this just happened. So, like, we've had how many months of these sorts of stories in the news, of these totally needless, horrible confrontations, And so out there this whole time, there's been a woman who has been going day by day, seeing the news, seeing the ridiculous spread of this Karen behavior, and it didn't modify her behavior. She still did it, given her chance to be that person. And next week, it'll be others. And the week after, it'll be others. And the same with, you know, George Floyd, the particular way that he was killed, the particular way that these protests started off. We've had multiple cops kill black men saying that they can't breathe since then. Like, even having the nationwide protests hasn't stopped the cops, not from killing black men, that's way too much to ask, but killing them in this very specific way. It hasn't even stopped that. It's madness how hard it is to get anything to change in America.
Right. It's a trend. It's become almost like, let me see how I can recreate. It's like a TikTok dance. How can I recreate this in my reimagine this event, right? And you hit the nail on the head. People are crappy all over, John, but when things are brought to light, if you are a douchebag, if you are a crappy person, you kind of like do your dirt behind closed doors if you're going to do your dirt. But these people are now more emboldened to be even more open with it. It's beyond me.
It's insane. For my garbage person of the week, I've got this individual. It is likely that you don't know his face, but it's even more likely that you've probably seen some of his tweets, because this individual is Caleb Hull, a digital communications strategist popular with pro-Trump Republicans, both in terms of working for these organizations, but also his memes and videos have been retweeted by members of Donald Trump's family and spread far and wide. And I'm just, for the purposes of logistics, I'm going to throw him in the trash now, but I want to tell you why. It's not just that, you know, he has turned American politics into just a meme war, complete waste of time, devoid of substance and all of that. It is the insane things that he said on his formerly private Twitter account that we now find out just 6 years ago were what he thought about a number of different groups in American politics. So he casually deployed the N-word on his @FLWTV Twitter account on several occasions and shared jokes in which the slur was the punchline. In one instance, he remarked that he was banned from a Twitch streamer's chat room after he spammed the N-word 17 times in a row. He promoted racist tropes about black people, including those involving watermelon and fried chicken, black children without fathers, and slaves picking cotton. He shared several memes containing these racist tropes, and he cited the same tropes while writing his own captions to images. For example, Hull captioned one image depicting a black man wearing clothing styled after world maps, saying, quote, "He's wearing a map so he can find his dad." There's more, so buckle up. He shared an image multiple times that depicts a piece of fried chicken hanging from a noose, and in one tweet, he juxtaposed the image on his timeline with an image of a black man. There's more. In several instances, he specifically attacked Avalanche, a black esports player and video game streamer, asking Avalanche where he picks his cotton. In another, Hull tweeted a racist image with the caption, "You're black." Right Wing Watch attempted to reach Avalanche via Twitter direct message, but did not receive a response. All of this, by the way, is coming from Jared Holt of Right Wing Watch. For the most part, he specifically was targeting black individuals, but he also made time to attack a wide range of groups, including Muslims, special needs children, Latinos. He used homophobic slurs all the time. Now, understand that this may sound bad, but before the article came out, he apologized, saying he was just a teenager at the time, and that he was going through a difficult time, including his parents' divorce and the death of his grandparents' depression, and said that he was vulnerable and impressionable and fell in with a bad crowd. This is all 6 years ago. When I was a teenager, my parents got divorced. I lost grandparents. Didn't do stuff like this, but...
Right. I was clinically depressed for 6 years and didn't even dream about saying anything egregious or derogatory or hateful about any marginalized group of people or people in general. So continue.
Yeah. And so understand, this isn't just some random person. No, he's worked with Turning Point USA as a field director. You know, oddly enough, a lot of their people have turned up to have racist pasts. He was on Washington Examiner's 30 Under 30 Red Politics Alert. The same year, other people on that list were Candace Owens, Tommy Lauren, and others. He
real attacks, winners.
Yeah, he attacks AIDS and cancer patients, the mentally disabled. And by the way, just for context, one of the people he more recently has really had a campaign against is Rick Wilson, the former Republican strategist. And he at one point took an image from Rick Wilson's Instagram that had a cooler painted on it with the Confederate flag painted on it that apparently was owned by Rick Wilson's son, and he attacked him for it. Rick Wilson's son, when that image came out, was 14, and it was 6 years ago. So this is at the same time that he was doing all of that stuff, he was attacking Rick Wilson's family, implying that, no, teenagers don't get to learn from what they did 6 years ago. Anyway, it's just, this person is the sort of Republican that gets fame and clout and is in all the right circles and gets to try to just erase their entire past. Pretend,
right,
that, oh yeah, sure, I did that stuff before, but that's not me. That's not me now.
Socialite disgustingness at its finest. And the thing is that these obligatory apologies about I've done work, I've through faith and through healing and through this, I've gotten the help I needed. No. All of the racist and crappy things he said covered a whole swath of different people with intentional items that you have to really think about using to be racist against somebody. He just got caught. He's probably still this person, and it doesn't matter. There's people, I mean, you make a choice to say those things. You choose to adopt those ideals. You know, yeah, people go through bad things all the time. People lose family members. People lose jobs. People lose limbs. So many crappy things happen in life that don't result in someone being that racist, that homophobic, xenophobic, transphobic, whatever, to that magnitude.
Yeah.
So there's no apologies. These apologies, John, just kill me. They just do my head in because it's like they all sound the same. I'm doing better. That happened at a time in my life where I didn't know. I got in with the wrong people. It's no, you attracted those people because that's who you were.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, like
I've been depressed
every time.
Yeah, my dad died of cancer when I was a teenager. Didn't lose it. And by the way, there's probably quite a few people watching this that have experienced depression. The idea that naturally makes you a racist is going to come as a shock to a lot of people who have depression and are not racists. And so here's the thing. It's not up to me, but I would say there have been people who have said things a long time ago and appear to be different people now. Now, it's still up to the individual whether that matters, whether you can ever absolve yourself of the things that you said and you did. And again, it's not up to me. But we can look at more recently what he's done and tried to figure out, has he actually changed? Because the thing is, he recently, this is just in June, mocked reports that a noose was found hanging in a stall used by black NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace. He thought it was really funny. He's the guy that was sharing the images of fried chicken in a noose. So back when he felt comfortable being explicitly racist, he used images of nooses. Now he can't do that. But he still thinks it's kind of funny, like, haha, like, oh, you're worried about a noose. So that's the version that's acceptable. Last January, when there was concern over this image of Covington Catholic High School students in blackface at a basketball game, he attacked those who were offended by it, saying, this is just a blackout game. It's a normal thing. Mm-hmm. So he's not necessarily spamming the N-word 17 times in a row, but he's attacking people who have a problem with blackface. So that's sort of the evolution. That doesn't, to me, signal a fundamental change and like a reconciliation. His apology for what he'd said before was an attempt to get out ahead of this story because he'd been reached for comment on it. It's not, you know, I really have to come to grips with the things that I've said and done because I now understand how fundamentally wrong I was and I have a different view of these things. He doesn't have a different view. He's just a little bit more careful about what he says in public.
And that part, John. And that also goes into how people are now enacting their racism and their bad behavior in 2020. It's become more covert and more sinister because all eyes are unearthing this. So people that are really just not good people are going to find different ways, passive aggressive ways to still be racist. I agree with you 1,000%. This guy, from what we're seeing, has not changed at all. Like I said earlier, he found ways to bring to light and throw daggers of racism using things that are historically racist, nooses, fried chicken, all those things. He had to really do his research, right? In 2020, he's done the same thing. Mm-hmm. He's done the same thing. It's just now a more covert way of being an a-hole. I don't think he's changed at all. And you said fundamentally, he has not fundamentally changed at all from what we're seeing.
100%. And thus, garbage person. And important because he's not just some rando. Like, he's tied in. He's the future of the Republican Party's media strategy.
Right. Very well
connected. Slightly more sophisticated racism. Slightly. You know what? We had my garbage person. We had Jason's garbage person. But what does the TDR community think? Well, we gave you a poll almost exactly a day ago. And we asked you to choose. Amongst the choices were Trump and the GOP for trying to repeal the ACA amidst the pandemic. Trump for retweeting the white power thing. GOP governors for reopening too early and spreading misinformation about COVID, and Gilead Pharmaceuticals for setting the price of a potential COVID treatment, remdesivir, at $3,000. This is all garbage. Which is the most garbage? And after 15,000 votes, the TDR community has made clear that they can't decide because all of the above got 74% of the vote. And so Trump and the GOP for the ACA move wins with 10% of the vote. We've never seen all of the above soak up more of the vote than this. Gilead also doing quite well with 7%. But man, it was apparently very difficult for the TDR community to come to consensus. And so Trump and the GOP get it. And for a good reason, trying to get rid of the ACA during a pandemic is a ghoulish move if I've ever seen one. But that's what the TDR community thinks. If you pay attention to news coming out of the military over the past few years, it is clear that there is a problem in our armed forces with white supremacy. But it isn't necessarily one that the military seems to be taking all that seriously just yet. And joining us now to talk about the current state of this problem and what might come from it in the future is senior reporter for The Guardian US, Lois Beckett. Welcome to the program.
Great to talk with you.
Great to have you here. You had a write-up recently about this, where you go through the history of some incidents of white supremacist potential domestic terrorism, or, you know, actual domestic terrorism that was just fascinating. And so I'd like to start off, just give us an idea, how big of a problem is this? How much information do we have about how many of our soldiers ascribe to this white nationalist or white supremacist ideology?
We have almost no real data on how widespread this problem is. What we do know is that there have been a troubling number of active duty service members, as well as veterans, who are leading some of the most infamous white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups that have emerged over the past couple of years, and who have been involved in some of the most violent organizing, including the neo-Nazi groups The Base and Adam Waffen, which has been linked to 5 killings in recent years.
Exactly. And yeah, as you point out, I know it's difficult, and simply polling soldiers seems unlikely to reveal much. But there was a poll that you cite in your piece about have you witnessed racist acts and things like that? And that did seem like a significant chunk of soldiers had recently seen something white supremacist or something like that in their experience.
So it was 36% of active duty members of Military Times, which is a news organization that covers military issues, said that they had seen evidence of racism and white supremacy in the ranks. An even larger number, more than half of military members of color, said that they had seen evidence in the military. And that's a survey that's been done over the past 3 years and has gone up each year. So it's clearly people who are inside the military are saying, this is something I have seen. This is happening. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And so one of the things that I found most interesting about your article was the like what you are allowed to do as a soldier, what the military thinks is acceptable, and what you have to do for them to draw the line when it comes to being involved in some sort of white nationalist or white supremacist group. So can you tell us a little bit about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable?
So one of the things that is pretty astonishing is that mere membership in an extremist organization in a white supremacist group is not actually enough to get you kicked out or totally disciplined from the military, that there are regulations that say that active participation in a white supremacist or other extremist group is something that you are not allowed to do. But in a hearing in Congress in February, multiple members of Congress were just listening astonished as they were told that it is technically okay to be a member of a white supremacist organization as long as you are not handing out flyers, fundraising, actually being involved. And at that hearing, there was a lot of concern about a member of the Air Force in Colorado who had been outed by anti-fascist activists as a leader in a local chapter of Identity Europa, one of the most problematic white nationalist groups, which had a strong presence in Charlottesville. And he, even months after this had been made public, was still on active duty, was eventually demoted. And only after a congressional hearing in which his name came up repeatedly, did a panel announce that he had been recommended for firing from the Air Force because of this.
So that appears to imply to me that this distinction between just being a mere member and being an active participant, it doesn't seem like that is even actually the standard, because, it's hard to imagine being more actively involved than being the actual leader of one of these groups. And for that to not immediately cause you to be taken out, do we know if there are cases where other soldiers have been removed from active service because of active membership in these groups?
Yes, there are some instances, including a member of Adam Waffen and someone who had been documented actually beating people up in Charlottesville, a Marine, was eventually kicked out. But there aren't very large numbers of people who are actually facing true consequences. And just the slowness and the amount of discretion from military commanders on this issue is something that is of concern, certainly to members of Congress, and to a large number of people who are just worried that the military is not taking this seriously enough.
And so you've mentioned that hearing and how they seem to be shocked by this. Have you seen any efforts by these legislators to actually do something to change the standard for being removed from active service?
So California Congresswoman Jackie Speier is taking a lead on this. Just today, she has announced that in the new defense budget, she has added an amendment that would require the Department of Defense to appoint a special inspector general to investigate white supremacy in the military and to produce some real data, as well as to add a specific offense related to violent extremism to the Code of Military Justice. All different efforts, all with the same goal, to actually count and get more public data on this problem and to ask the Department of Defense just to be more proactive in dealing with this issue.
And anything from the GOP about this? Do they seem to be concerned about this?
In the House hearing, there were Republican members who did say, like, we want the Department of Defense to do more to identify members of hate groups, sort of find out who they are, get them out, and stop them from coming in the first place. So there is some bipartisan acknowledgement that this is dangerous. And that's certainly obvious from one of the most recent cases, which is an Army private, Ethan Melzer, a 22-year-old, who was conspiring with a British neo-Nazi satanic group to share private information, classified information on his own unit for the purpose of attacking them. So it's very clear that this is a danger for members of the U.S. military as well as for civilians. And it's a danger to all members, although, of course, particularly concerning for Black service members and other service members of color.
Yeah, it sounds like, for the very least, for unit cohesion, morale, and all of that, you'd want to take this seriously, but also potentially to save the lives of active duty service members. If this one individual was attempting to set up some sort of ambush, is it possible? Is it likely that others might as well? That seems like something they should certainly take seriously. I also wanted to talk to you about, in your article, you talk about veterans specifically. So we're not talking about active duty members of the military right now. We're talking about people who had previously served, their involvement in some of these extremist groups, both presently, the so-called Boogaloo movement, but also over the last century or so. Can you walk us through a few of the highlights in this area?
So one of the things that's really important to understand about white supremacist and white power organizing in the United States is that military veterans have been part of it for over 100 years. Kathleen Ballou is a scholar who wrote Bring the War Home, which is a book that looks specifically at the connection between military members and white supremacist groups. And she has found that in the wake of different world wars and in the wake of the Vietnam War, big surges in white power organizing at home that have involved military veterans as part of that, but are also deeply caught up with the ideology of what it meant to fight those wars. And in the case of Vietnam, in the feeling of some white military members of betrayal, that the country had betrayed them, sort of had been emasculated. And so a lot of the in the 70s and 80s, the growth of the Klan and other white power groups was driven by those concerns and anxieties about Vietnam and targeted Vietnamese refugees as well as Black Americans. So certainly we've seen that again in the wake of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that anti-Muslim sentiment, xenophobic sentiment is very much part of the current white power and white supremacist movement here. And one of the really troubling things in looking at that history is seeing again and again how slow the military was to take this problem seriously. So in the 1970s and 1980s, the Ku Klux Klan was actively organizing on US military bases. In fact, David Duke got one of his big political boosts by showing up at Camp Pendleton in Southern California to take the side of some Ku Klux Klan members who had gotten in an altercation with Black Marines there. And time and time again, the military has waited years to take really strong steps to address this problem that we are seeing once again, still despite clear evidence that this might not be the largest number of people, but it's a very dangerous number of people who are actively undermining their own fellow soldiers, and still a real hesitancy to tackle the problem with the full force that many people would like to see.
Wow, some of that is just amazing. Both, you know, what has been done, but also what hasn't been done in response, the lack of prioritization of this. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the Boogaloo ideology. I've seen it described and talked to people who describe it as people who have come together around this idea that hypothetically some sort of civil war needs to be necessary, although they might disagree on other specifics politically. Is that, you've seen a lot of it in the news recently. Do you believe that that is the focus on it, the prioritizing it right now, is an accurate reflection of the threat that it poses, and particularly veterans being involved in this movement? Or do you think that that might be a bit too much focus on one part of a more complex, larger problem?
So I think it's really important to understand that the Boogaloo as sort of an anti-government ideology is filled with people who are white power activists. Doesn't mean that everybody who affiliates themselves in some way with this idea of civil war thinks of themselves as a white nationalist or as a white power supporter, but definitely big strains of white supremacy in that movement. And it is just very troubling the extent to which military veterans have been involved in these incidents and are actively talking about civil war. And what's one of the most troubling things about the movement is, and the extent to which it's a movement still being debated, it's a nascent movement and an embryonic movement, but you have people who are making jokes online and talking ironically and less ironically about killing federal agents, and they're calling themselves the Mujahideen, like the Afghani Mujahideen. And so what we are seeing is American soldiers who have been trained to fight insurgencies in other countries making jokes and making plans about creating an insurgency in their own country against our current government. In reviewing cases of Boogaloo rhetoric linked to arrests, found more than 15 arrests and 5 deaths across the country in the past year that have been linked to this ideology. 8 of the people arrested and charged were either military veterans or active duty service members. So definitely something that the military is aware of, but is falling under this same umbrella of active participation is banned, but mere membership is a question mark.
You know, and I really have to wonder if they found a soldier was technically a member of ISIS, but not active, would they be okay with that person continuing to serve? Like, it seems like a very specific carve out for one area of political extremist groups that I have a feeling they probably would not carry through to other areas. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know if that's ever been tested.
Certainly that is a question that members of Congress were asking as well. And, you know, more broadly, it is complicated. We do not want the Department of Defense, infringing on soldiers' free speech or policing their thoughts, right? There's obviously a balance here. But if you are a white supremacist or a member of a white supremacist group, you are actively trying to undermine the government of this country. You are, you know, this is a treasonous act. If you want to create a white ethnostate, you are not serving the United States, and you are planning acts of terrorism against the United States, so that there is a clear problem with that.
Exactly. One final question, and this might be beyond the information that we actually have, but it seems bad enough if these groups are recruiting from people coming out of the military, or if people are leaving the military feeling disaffected for one of a number of reasons and then seeking out these groups. But considering how you've stressed the scholar talking about the importance of the skills and the training that these soldiers get that they can then bring to these movements, do we have any reason to believe that hypothetically some of these groups might be putting people through military training specifically to then bring the skills back to these organizations?
Oh, that's not hypothetical. That has already happened. One of the leaders of Adam Waffen, the very violent neo-Nazi group, was in the, I believe, Florida Army National Guard, and he was interested in doing that training. Like, this is something that extremist groups routinely do. They not only seek out veterans who have these skills, they are interested in having people join the Army to get the training, which is one of the reasons that members of Congress are interested in better screening of social media as people are enlisting, to try to find people who are actively participating in extremist groups counter to the values of the United States, but who are trying to join the U.S. military.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredibly scary. People need to take this seriously, and hopefully our government doesn't forget about it. I know we've got other things that we're dealing with too, but this needs to be addressed. If you are watching this and you found it interesting and want more information, the article is How the U.S. Military Has Failed to Address White Supremacy in Its Ranks, available online now. Lois Beckett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Great to talk with you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.